Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. This is week 2 of the April 2024 Model Railroader magazine. Today we will be reading the following articles: News and Reviews, Ask Model Railroader, Railway Post Office, and Step by Step. News and Reviews section. Athearn HO Scale EMD SW1500. The Electromotive Division SW1500, part of the Athearn HO Scale product lineup since 1991, is back. The latest release of the end cab switcher is offered with a newly designed CAN motor, light-emitting diode lighting, and a dual-mode Soundtracks Tsunami 2 decoder. Electromotive Division produced the SW1500 from July 1966 until January 1974. During that time, 808 units were produced. The 1500 horsepower switchers were equipped with a 12-645E engine. The sample we received is decorated as Wisconsin Central, or WC, 1569. The regional carrier acquired the former Southern Pacific unit in 1998. It wore the railroad's maroon and gold scheme through October 2002, when it was repainted into the colors of WC's new owner, Canadian National. The Athearn model has an injection-molded plastic shell and die-cast metal chassis. Details on the front and rear pilots of the WC model include a weed-cutter snowplow, MU and trainline hoses with the glad hands picked in silver, and plastic uncoupling levers. The cap details on the WC switcher accurately reflect the unit's SP heritage. On the back of the cab, plates cover the locations of the removed single and twin gyrolights. The front light package features a similar treatment. Number boxes with factory-printed number boards are on the front of the cab. Other railroad-specific features on the WC locomotive include a whip-style antenna and vent on top of the cab, flexicoil trucks, an all-weather window, and speed recorder cable. Our sample is decorated in WC's maroon and gold paint scheme. The paint is smooth and evenly applied, and the separation lines between colors are crisp. The model's dimensions closely follow data published in the Model Railroader Diesel Cyclopedia Volume 2, Diesel Locomotives, Comeback Books, out of print. There were a few detailed discrepancies between the model and the prototype. The model has molded marker lights on both ends, but they should be plated over. Prototype images also show the WC1569 with pilot-mounted ditch lights on both ends and spark arresters. The sample we received has a dual-mode Soundtracks Tsunami 2 sound decoder. I used an NCE power cab to test the model at the workbench. At step 1, the model moved at 6 scale miles per hour. At step 28, I recorded a top speed of 77 scale miles per hour. The full-size SW1500 had a top speed of 65 miles per hour. The model's speed range can be fine-tuned using configuration variables. I took the SW1500 over to the Milwaukee, Racine, and Troy for further testing. The locomotive performed well when working the interchange at Jones Island. Finally, I ran the SW1500 up the 3% grade between Williams Bay and Sky Ridge. The model was able to pull 6 50-foot boxcars up the hill. Though the HO scale SW1500 is more than 30 years old, it's refreshing to see Athearn continue to find ways to improve it. The end cap switcher certainly has come a long way from its blue box kit origins. Cody Grivno, Senior Editor. Facts and features. Price. Direct current model with 21-pin NEM connector, $219.99. With dual-mode Soundtracks Tsunami 2 sound decoder, $319.99. Manufacturer, Athearn Trains, 2904 Research Road, Champaign, Illinois, 61822, athern.com. Era, late 1990s through early 2002 as decorated. Road names, Wisconsin Central, Burlington Northern, Conrail, St. Louis Southwestern, Cotton Belt, and Western Pacific in three road numbers per scheme. Also available undecorated, Standard and Southern Pacific or Cotton Belt detail packages. Features. First, correctly gauged wheels. Next, McHenry scale couplers at correct height. Next, minimum radius 18 inches. And finally, weight 8.8 ounces. Ask Model Railroader section by Stephen Ott. Why are there no kits for a glass plant? Question. I'm slowly building the industries on my HO layout and can't seem to find one in particular, a glass plant. I see all types of industries one can buy an HO scale, but no one seems to make a glass plant. Why not? I once worked for one of the largest glass container manufacturers in the country. Several railroads brought us silica sand, potash, limestone, and cullet. Outbound, we loaded over-the-road trailers and intermodal containers. You'd think a glass plant would be a good addition to a layout, what with the rail traffic required to keep it running 24/7. Signed, Dana Vincent. Answer. You're right. Modeling a glass plant would be a fascinating subject that can generate a lot of rail traffic for a model railroad. The primary ingredients of glass are sand, powdered limestone, and soda ash, all of which would be delivered by rail in covered hoppers. These materials would be unloaded in covered sheds and stored in silos on site. A glass plant would also receive materials used in the polishing and finishing process, like salt cake, iron oxide powder, and felt. Packaging material, such as cardboard, wood, styrofoam, and bubble wrap, could arrive by boxcar. Some plants might ship their product in boxcars as well. Glass is made by melting the sand and other raw materials together into a viscous liquid at very high heat. In a modern float glass plant, the molten glass is extruded onto a pool of molten tin. Since this metal is both denser than glass and melts at a lower temperature, the glass can float along on this perfectly flat surface while it cools and solidifies. It's then cut, finished, and packaged for shipping. Older plants use rollers to flatten and shape the glass as it cools, then grind and polish it. Most of this information came from Henry Freeman's article, A Plug-and-Play Industry for Your Railroad, published in the January 2003 Model Railroader. In that article, Henry goes into more detail about how a glass plant is designed, how it operates, and how the railroad would serve it. If you're a subscriber to our website, trains.com, you can find the HO scale track plan for that article by searching for, quote, Pittsburgh plate glass, end quote. As for why you can't find a scale model kit of a glass plant out there, it's probably because from the outside they look pretty generic. See the picture above. An assortment of large brick, concrete, and corrugated metal industrial structures would do. Modeling a glass plant can take a lot of layout space. You might consider modeling only the unloading shed and warehouse areas of the factory in 3D and represent the rest of the plant with low-profile background buildings or photo backdrops. Next question from Peter Burris. Which steam locomotive wheel configurations are better for pulling a train up a hill versus long freight loads a long distance, and why? Also, what is the relation between the drive wheels and the cylinders? Answer. The relationships between steam locomotive power and its moving parts are complicated. If it wasn't, there wouldn't have been so many different cylinder, valve, firebox, boiler, and wheel combinations tried and built. But there are some general rules. The wheel configurations of a steam locomotive come down to two factors, tractive effort versus speed. Both are desirable because the stronger the tractive effort, aka drawbar pull, the more cars the engine can pull. And the faster the engine can go, the faster those cars can get to their destinations. Unfortunately, there's a direct trade-off between the two factors. Larger drive wheels, which travel farther per revolution thanks to their larger circumference, make for a faster engine. Smaller drive wheels, which have more mechanical advantage than larger ones, pull harder but move slower. Steam locomotive power is also related to cylinder size and shape. A large diameter cylinder will provide more power than a small one, but over a shorter distance. A large drive wheel needs a cylinder with a longer stroke, which, all other things, such as the volume of steam produced, being equal, means a smaller cylinder diameter, which means less power. Power also depends on how much steam the boiler can produce, which is directly related to the size of the firebox and boiler. The larger and heavier the locomotive is, the more wheels it needs. Freight locomotives need more traction to pull heavier loads, so it will have more drivers rather than unpowered lead and trailing axles whose purpose is simply to carry the engine's weight. There are other factors that govern the number of drive wheels versus leading and trailing axles, such as the fact that you can't fit a large firebox between the drivers, so it has to be supported by a larger trailing truck. But in general, when you see a locomotive with a high number of small driver wheels, that's generally a freight engine, built for pulling strength. An engine with fewer but larger drivers is usually passenger power, made for speed. The next question comes from Steve Perry. I model a bridge line connecting the Nickel Plate, NKP, at Wheeling, West Virginia, with the Norfolk and Western, NNW, at Bluefield, West Virginia. I roster several EMD GP30s and some ALCO units, all in NKP livery. Most of my steam power is lettered for NNW. I've seen photos of locomotives with a placard indicating it is leased. I would like to make decals of such a placard to place on some of my locomotives indicating they are leased to my freelanced railroad. Please give me the wording I can use. I have two GP30s numbered 902. One of those is a candidate for leasing. If I patch an additional digit, does it have to be in the same font as the current digits? That is, if the current digits are in Railroad Roman, could I use a Railroad Gothic digit of the same size for the patch? Lastly, should the number I add be on the left or the right on the current number? Answer. The only locomotives I've seen with a placard or lettering indicating they're leased are those belonging to leasing companies, such as CIT Rail Resources, CITX, Helm Leasing Corporation, or HLCX, Pioneer Rail Equipment, PREX, and National Railway Equipment, or NREX. The X at the end of those reporting marks indicates that the equipment is privately owned and doesn't belong to a railroad. This is usually enough to indicate that a locomotive is a leased unit, so even leasing companies don't always bother to further label their equipment as such. And even when they do, the lettering lists the locomotive's owner, not who it's leased to. A railroad that has been assigned to long-term use on a foreign road will usually not be labeled as leased. A lease arrangement is by nature temporary, and when the original owner gets the unit back, it isn't going to want to have to paint over a lease placard. You also said you have two GP30s with the same number and asked about renumbering one of them. If those two diesels belong to the same railroad and therefore also have the same reporting marks, one should be renumbered, but that doesn't have anything to do with its lease status. On the prototype, locomotives and rolling stock are frequently, quote, patched out, end quote, or renumbered without being repainted. Railroads usually like to keep their engines numbered in an orderly way, so they wouldn't simply append a digit to the beginning or end of the previous road number. They would want it to have a number in the same range as other locomotives of the same type. The old number would instead be covered with paint or a patch of vinyl film and a completely new number added on top, as in the photo seen above. You don't have to worry about matching typefaces that way either. Check out our August 2018, December 2014, and July 2012 issues for articles demonstrating techniques for patching out diesels and freight cars. The next question comes from Tony Van Bergen. Many years ago, in the mid-1980s, if memory serves me correctly, Model Railroader had an article about building a metal paint booth. Is this article available in the magazine's archives? Answer. It sure is. Every article we've ever published is available to archive subscribers on the Trains.com website. The article you're looking for is an installment of the Paint Shop column from the January 1988 issue. The Paint Shop spray booth was designed by Model Railroader staffer Gordon Odegaard to be buildable by a hobbyist without sheet metal bending experience or specialized tools. For a portable option, check out a deluxe spray paint booth in our August 1983 issue. Hobbyist Ken Brer explained in that article how he built a self-contained plywood booth with wood doors to keep the area looking neat when the booth is not in use. The next question is from Randy Bartlett in Madison, Tennessee. I have a tight HO scale helix with a grade of 3%. My smaller steam engines have a hard time pulling more than two or three cars up the grade. I know the standard answers. Increase engine weight, add a second engine, apply bullfrog snot to the drivers, and make sure car trucks roll smoothly. But I'm curious, has anyone ever tried to imitate the prototype method of applying sand? I'm considering roughing up the rails with sandpaper. Has anyone ever tried that, and if so, what problems did they run into? Answer. Hi, Randy. I haven't heard of anyone trying that idea, but I'm still confident in advising you not to do it. The reason is power, not pulling power, but electricity. Roughing up the surface of your railheads might improve your model locomotive's traction, but it would do so at the expense of electrical contact. Model railroad wheels already contact only a very small patch of the railhead. A rough rail surface would, by definition, contact the wheel less reliably. The difference might not be a big one, but the smaller your pickup wheels, the more significant the difference would be. But even worse would be a problem that would just increase over time: rail gunk. The microscopic pits and scratches you'd be etching into your railheads would become natural places for non-conductive grime to build up. One theory of where this mysterious stuff comes from is carbon from electrical sparking between the wheels and the rails. If this theory is true, rough railheads would also lead to more arcing and more gunk. I suggest you stick with your standard answers. I reviewed bullfrog snot in our May 2009 issue, and I can recommend it. Just make sure you only apply it to one drive axle per locomotive. The next section is Railway Post Office, conducted by Stephen Ott. The first section is titled Another Model Railroader Anniversary Commemorated. The January Model Railroader arrived today, and in it is an ad for a Model Railroader 90th Anniversary boxcar. Immediately, I grabbed my camera and went to the display shelves over my staging yard. Here's my photo of the 25th anniversary car I bought as a new Model Railroader subscriber in 1958. The car is by Mantua. It has, quote, NMRA couplers, end quote, and its wheel flanges are so big that they would ride the spike heads on my layout. This was one of my first cars, and it's a nostalgic reminder of my 66-year subscription to Model Railroader from age 11 to 77 and still going strong. Signed, Greg Condon. The next section is titled Fremont Feedback. Very pleased to see a project using Fremo from Welcome to Fremont Mills in January edition. I had two layouts in the past. Moving multiple times and changing space available for a layout delayed my participation in the hobby. Fremo gave me a way to participate again. Were I to have the opportunity to build a large layout, it would be based on a modular plan. Fremo also allowed me to start with just a couple of modules, to which I've added when I realized I needed more. I encourage all modelers to consider building modules. Using the Fremo standard would also let you take a section of which you are particularly proud to Fremo clubs to share your ideas and receive input from others. Signed, Ed Spaulding, Soap Lake, Washington, Inland Washington Fremo Gang. I just read the January article about the Fremont project layout, and it was great. I've designed many Fremo modules, and I thought that your planning process was spot on. Layouts often lack curved modules, which can make it a challenge for layout designers to fit the layout into the available space. I look forward to the remaining three installments, as well as more articles about Fremo and Fremon in the future. The invitation for the Fremo layout at the Amherst Railway Society Railroad Hobby Show in Springfield, Massachusetts, just went out, and I understand that Model Railroader was invited to bring Fremont to the show. If you are able to attend, that might get me to travel 7 hours to the show in January. Lastly, I am building a list of all Fremo and Fremont groups in North America, which can be found on the membership page of the Fremo website at www.free-mo.org/membership. My hope is that the list will be used by people to find a group near them. If readers know of groups that are missing from this list, they can advise me through a form on the website so I can keep the list up to date. Thank you. Signed, Steve Adamson. I enjoyed the first Fremont Mills article. I have a suggestion for other future plans. I suggest that when Model Railroaders send staff to national and regional conventions, they bring Fremont Mills along and include it in the convention's Fremo HO layout. Be sure and bring some MR&T trains too, and join in the fun of running trains on the full layout. I'm a member of the North Raleigh Model Railroad Club. We specialize in N-track and T-track modules. I do T-track since I have no space for a layout at home, and because they are small, light, and easy to transport to shows. Please consider including more articles on modular model railroading in the future issues of Model Railroader. This would show people that one doesn't need a spare room or basement to enjoy model railroading. Signed, John Page, Cary, North Carolina. The next section is Step by Step by Cheryl Sassy. How to Scratch Build Spruce Trees. Frequent readers of Model Railroader know that I've been building a variety of trees for my husband, Lou's, on 30 Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes layout. Since 2019, I've shared my techniques for constructing hardwoods, white birch, and white pines. This time around, he asked me to try my hand at spruce trees. The methods demonstrated in this article are best suited for, quote, hero, end quote, or foreground trees. These are trees that have a high level of detail and are intended to be near the front of the layout. If you're trying to populate a large section of model railroad, commercial trees are a better and less time-consuming option. As shown in the photo above, spruce trees added a nice pop of color and texture to Lou's layout. If you need some foreground trees for your model railroad, give these techniques a try. Step 1, materials list. Though it looks like I used a lot of materials to scratch build spruce trees, many of them can be used for modeling other tree types. Here's the supplies I used. The key items are caspia, sesame bloom, 22 gauge floral wire, floral tape, wire cutters, and scissors. I sourced the caspia from Save on Crafts, reachable at 800-928-6175, or laura-c at list-companyinc.com. Sesame bloom can be found on sites like Etsy, though it may not always be in stock. For paints, I used Rust-Oleum Painter's Touch 2X Hunt Club Green, 268414, and Stops Rust Hunter Green, 773-2830, Satin Spray Paint, Mars Black, Raw Umber, and White Tube Acrylics, and Model Master Engine Black, Reefer White, and Roof Brown Acrylics. The Tester Corporation discontinued Model Master Paints a few years ago. You can find similar acrylic colors designed for brush painting in the Vallejo Model Color and Ammo by MIG Rail Center Lines. I used a few small brushes to apply the tube acrylics and hobby paints. Additional items I used were fine conifer green ground foam, a pin vise, number 65 bit, number 18 by 1 inch brads, styrofoam, tap water, a paint palette, a ruler, hairspray, and wood glue. Step 2. Tackling the trunk. I started work on the spruce trees by wrapping sesame bloom stems and a length of floral wire in floral tape. I used thin stems near the top of the tree trunk and thicker stems, and more of them, closer to the base. I wrapped the floral tape as tightly as I could around the wire and stems. Since I would be inserting branches into the trunk later on, I wanted as sturdy a structure as possible. Two wrapped trunks, complete with number 18 by 1 inch brad mounting pins, are shown in figure 2. Next, I mixed Mars Black, raw umber, and white tube acrylics on a paint palette and applied them to the trunk with a brush. The difference between the wrapped and painted trunks is shown in figure 4. After the tube acrylics had dried, I blended Model Master Engine Black, Reefer White, and Roof Brown acrylics and brushed them onto the trunk. I then applied light washes of Engine Black and Roof Brown over the base coat. This gives the trunk a realistic appearance. Step 3, bring on the branches. I modeled the branch structure on the spruce trees using caspia. First, I sprayed the natural material with Rust-Oleum Painter's Touch 2X Hunt Club Green and Stops Rust Hunter Green Satin Spray Paint. Use the paints in a well-ventilated area, preferably a spray booth, and wear a respirator, nitrile gloves, and eye protection. After the paint had dried, I trimmed sprigs from the caspia using scissors. Then I applied a small sprig to the top of the tree with wood glue. I used a number 65 bit and a pin vise to drill holes in the trunk for the branches. Once I'd finished drilling the holes in the trunk, I dipped the caspia sprigs in wood glue and inserted their stems into the trunk. I used shorter sprigs near the top and progressively longer ones as I worked towards the base of the tree. When in doubt on how a tree should look, refer to prototype photos. I hand-painted some of the branches that wouldn't receive foliage with Model Master Engine Black and inserted them near the bottom of the trunk. These represent dead branches you can see how they look in photo 2 of step 4 below. Step 4, finishing touches. After I attached all of the branches, I brush painted the locations where they attached to the trunk with Model Master Roof Brown, being careful not to get paint on the areas I painted green. This blends the branch color with the trunk while hiding any shiny spots of excess glue. Then I sprayed the trees with Tester's Dull Coat to give them a uniform flat finish. As with the spray paint, do this in a well-ventilated area and wear proper personal protective gear. Finally, I sprayed the tree with unscented hairspray and sprinkled fine conifer green ground foam on the branches. Apply the ground foam above a clean work surface or over a container so you can reclaim any material that doesn't stick to the branches. With that, the spruce trees were ready to plant on Lou's On 30 Sandy River and Rangeley Lakes layout. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader Magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.